This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 367, was produced on March 16th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Groman returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss how the U.S. dollar has fared in the wake of central bank divestitures and some countries settling oil transactions in other currencies. And then we'll discuss Luke's outlook for the dollar and for markets in the wake of Silicon Valley Bank's collapse after the biggest bank run in history last Thursday. And yes, folks, there has been a disturbance in the force since our last podcast, so we'll also include a short segment to review what happened at Silicon Valley Bank, what it means, and what comes next after the feature interview with Luke and before we dive into our usual post-game chart deck.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, March 15, 2023. The S&P 500 was down 1.8%, closing at 3925. But what is actually noteworthy is that in spite of the weakness in financials, equity markets are resiliently holding in, with even the NASDAQ up close to 1% week over week. That US dollar index down 0.9%, closing at 104.75. But the next moves really will hinge on the reactions to potential central bank pivots. The April WTI crude oil contract down 11.8%, closing at 67.61. We will look at that chart, and Eric will have those EIA inventory data in the post-game segment. Gold up 6.2% to 1931, a solid breakout. Copper down 4.6%, closing at 384, material breakdown of an established support line. Uranium down 2.2%, closing at 50.05. And that US 10-year treasury yield down 54 basis points, closing at 345 points. The bond markets are 100% where the big action is. The key news to watch, we recorded this before the release of the ECB monetary policy statement today, will be the first clues how central banks are going to be reacting to this crisis. And next week, we have two central banks reporting with the FOMC preface conference on Wednesday, which is now going to be critical. And that Thursday morning, we're going to hear from the Bank of England on their monetary policy. Now, this week's feature interview guest is Forest for the Trees founder, Luke Groman. Eric, why did we invite Luke back on the show as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, Luke is a listener favorite, and he's also the guy who predicted a bunch of things that he was ridiculed for at the time, but which have come true recently, including central banks divesting their treasury holdings, meaningful volumes of oil transactions now being settled not in U.S. dollars, and so forth. And it's timely to get Luke back this week because given all of these new concerns about the stability of the U.S. financial system in the wake of the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, it's a perfect time to talk about the dollar and its stability and where it's headed ultimately compared to other currencies and whether or not it can maintain its reserves currency status indefinitely.
Eric's interview with Luke Groman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables, or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Luke Grohman, founder of Forest for the Trees. Luke, what a week. The big news, of course, that came out over the weekend was the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. This is a bank which specialized in setting up fundings for through venture capital firms for startups in Silicon Valley. Therefore, a lot of big companies with a lot of cash that was not insured. That bank failed, I think, because of the Fed's hiking cycle. Do you think that that was the cause? And if not, what was the cause? How do you interpret this? And what does it mean for the Fed's hiking cycle?
Yeah, thanks for being back on, Eric. I agree. I think it was ultimately the Fed's hiking cycle and really inflation driving the Fed's hiking cycle that caused it. Ultimately, you put that bank and a number of other banks in a position where they have to compete with the treasury market, the short-term treasury market in particular, the money markets, money market funds, where the yields there are, call it, at least before today's trading, 4.75% for 30-day money, give or take. And so it puts the banks in an uncomfortable position of either having to raise deposit rates, which will put pressure on net interest margins and earnings, which is never popular with bank managements and bank investors, or they need to sell these bonds to fund the deposit outflows. But the problem is these were supposed to be high quality liquid assets, and they've been not so liquid, and they are down on price. And so the banks, and I'm not an expert on bank accounting, so take this with a grain of salt, but the gist of it is that the banks don't have to take a mark on big chunks of their securities books unless a couple of things happen. And one of those things being if they sell the bonds. So they would have to mark losses, and that would also hurt earnings. Or they have to issue a bunch of equity or otherwise raise capital to replace the deposit funding, the cheap funding, as the deposits go elsewhere looking for yield. And so it sets up a choice of a number of choices for banks that all of which either hurt earnings or hurt margins or hurt earnings and margins or dilute shareholders, none of which they are really big fans of. So I agree with your assessment of it.
Luke, I see this as an indictment of Fed policy because, you know, everybody in the know understands that forward guidance, and I say that in air quotes, is basically just Fed speak for we're going to jawbone the market up or down in whichever direction we want to make it go. But what if some innocent banker were to take forward guidance at face value and say, this is the branch of the government that's supposed to tell me what to expect, and they're giving me an outlook saying the guidance from the Federal Reserve is we don't expect to be seeing increases in interest rates that are substantial for the next several years. So then bankers do exactly what bankers are supposed to do, which is they buy duration risk in order to invest the assets that they've received. The duration risk blows up in their face because they were following the Fed's forward guidance. And then if they use the government's accounting rules, or I should say because of the government's accounting rules, if they were to exercise any financial prudence and hedge that duration risk, that would disqualify them from mark-to-market, or it would enforce market-to-market accounting rules onto them. It would disqualify them from their hold-to-maturity accounting rules, and it would cause the entire bank's balance sheet to blow up. Is that the bank's fault, or is that the government's fault?
Yeah, and I would even go one further, because when you go back in time, remember, we go back to 2013 when China says the PBOC comes out and says we're not going to buy any more treasuries, we're not going to grow our holdings of treasuries anymore, and then 2014, You have high quality liquid asset or HQLA regulations that U.S. policymakers put in place that incents banks, broadly speaking, to buy more treasuries so that they have a store of high quality liquid assets that they can sell in liquidity crunches. So for exactly what they've just seen. And then recall as well, as you fast forward to 2020, the Fed suspended or exempted treasuries from SLR regulations, supplementary leverage ratio regulations, which basically took the funding cost of treasuries for banks to zero de facto as a way of basically helping the Fed finance these massive deficits that were taking place with the collapse in tax receipts and the explosion in stimulus payments. And so I agree with everything you just laid out there. And I would also add on top of that, that you've had a series of policy regulations over the last almost decade, essentially giving favorable treatment to the bank sector to buy more treasuries. And as I've made the point earlier, and as I've made it repeatedly over the years, is I think part of that was due to the U.S. having lost foreign central banks as a buyer, as a marginal buyer of treasuries 9 years ago. And so this is sort of a classic emerging market playbook, which is you regulate your banks into buying government debt by offering favorable regulatory treatments. And so there've been, point being, a number of these dynamics that have incented the banks to buy them. I wasn't even aware of the disqualification of the balance sheet treatment if you actually lay off the hedging risk. But assuming that's the case, then that further on a tactical basis does more of the same. So when I take a step back and I look at all of this, what jumps off the page at me is that whether it's bankers, whether it's the Fed, whether it's U.S. policymakers, whether it's Treasury, they all had the same bet on. And that bet was inflation's never coming back. And when we get these huge crises, the biggest ones tend to be exactly that type of situation, right? Where there is this unspoken, implicit bet that everybody has on in the same direction, right? With long-term capital management, when you looked at their book, they were short quality and long crap. Well, you know, when you look at, you know, the banks and the situation in 2008, the bet everybody had on was home prices could never fall nationally. And I would argue that as you laid it out and the points that I made, the bet that sort of everybody had on was inflation's never coming back, and inflation came back.
Let's talk about what this means to the Fed's hiking cycle, because before this event happened, the general mood in the markets was, okay, there's a couple of analysts that have come out and said, not only has the Fed not finished hiking, but we could see even 50 basis point hikes again, rather than just 25, maybe as many as two or three more hikes. And in the worst case, might be 350s in a row, you know, another 150 basis points, you know, before the summer is out. Now we've got Goldman Sachs saying about that hike we anticipated in March, never mind. Nobody's really said, or at least as of Monday afternoon as we're recording this, and I should let our listeners know, we're discussing this right now on Monday afternoon. A lot will probably happen in this story before they hear it on Thursday evening. It seems like everybody's backing away from their predictions that there was going to be more aggressive hiking from the Fed. Does this mean the cycle's over? We're basically QT is finished at this point? Or how should we interpret this, Luke?
I think, yes, I think it is. They're really in this tough spot where they need to make a choice between letting the banking system kind of twist in the wind or let the release valve be the dollar and inflation. And ultimately, when I take a step back here too, I see that over the last, call it 7-8 years, the two biggest marginal buyers of treasuries have been the Fed and the U.S. banking system. And we know the Fed's not buying anymore. We know the economy's slowing. We know tax receipts are falling. We know interest expense and deficits are rising because of the Fed's hikes. So you've got Treasury's issuance has been rising. Treasury issuance from the U.S. Treasury has been rising, to clarify. You've had the Fed joining them, selling them. With the dollar strength last year, you had foreign selling. And now you're in this position where there's sort of one guy holding down the fort on the marginal side. And it's been in the big, in terms of just the rankings, and it's U.S. banks. And so the Fed faces a choice, which is, are we going to stop and are we going to do something to ameliorate this stress, or are we going to force these banks to begin taking losses on their treasury portfolios to, by virtue of selling treasuries to raise dollar liquidity to sort of give people their money back so they can take the money back and put it into T-bills? What you're talking about is the U.S. government effectively crowding out the U.S. banking system. Again, and I say again because we wrote for our clients last week, this isn't the first time we've seen a version of this. We saw this in 2019. You and I were talking regularly in 2019 through the summer of 2019, Eric, when Fed funds rates went over interest on excess reserves. And I was harping on it ad nauseum that, look, this means U.S. deficits combined with Fed QT is crowding out the U.S.'s own banking system. And sure enough, we had a repo rate spike and boom, the Fed reverses course and away we go. And this is really just a different version of that same dynamic. It's just happening at duration instead of the front end. So I think, gun to my head, that's it. Because I think the Fed, do not want to create more of a problem again in the Treasury market. And I say again because, oh, by the way, Friday afternoon, the Treasury Volatility Move Index went out at 140, which the creator of that index, Harley Bassman, noted in October of last year that once that index starts getting near 150, that means the Fed's losing control of the Treasury market. So to me, there's this still largely undiscussed side of this, which is, yes, the banking system side of it, but to me, this is ultimately about the Treasury market. And so because I don't think the Fed wants to lose control of the Treasury market and they are quietly close to doing so, I think they're done. And I think the release valve is going to be inflation,
So let's talk that through to the next step, because it seems to me, I think you're right, that they're going to react to this by saying, okay, we got to quit the hiking. Clearly, the Fed's mission, I've always said, is to continue a hiking cycle until they break something. Congratulations, guys. You've succeeded. You've broken something. So they can declare success that they broke something. But wait a minute. Now what's going to happen, I think, is they stop the hiking cycles. Inflation doesn't go away. We continue to see that inflation is probably going to become a bigger political issue. We're going into a presidential election cycle. You're going to see more inflation that's going to be reported as big news. You know, consumers, there's going to be a lot of Congress people standing up on whatever they can find to stand on, screaming at the top of their lungs about how somebody better do something about inflation. Where does that take us? Does the Fed then at some point come back in and try to resume another hiking cycle? Or you think they've been scared out of it by this? And if so, what does that mean in terms of trades? Clearly, gold is up, I think, just about exactly $100 or just over $100 since it bottomed just before this news came out, looking at 1919 right now as we're speaking. And I think the bottom was around 1812 just a week ago. So is gold going to continue to be the benefactor? Is it time to pile in? How do we trade this if we think that the Fed has basically boxed themselves in a corner where they know there's more inflation coming, but they're not going to be able to fight it?
I think it's the reacceleration of Argentina with U.S. characteristics trade that we saw in 2021. So gold, Bitcoin, commodities, industrials, energy. Back in 2021, we calculated that with what had already happened, with where debt to GDP was, the U.S. needed to let inflation run between 10 and 20% CPI per year for 4 to 5 years. That would get debt to GDP down to a sustainable level from which the Fed could normalize rates. And for a little bit, it looked like they were going to do that. And then all of a sudden, at the end of 21, early 22, the Fed and certain politicians panicked. Maybe it was that it was an election year. I don't know. But they did. And suddenly inflation went from back burner to COVID to front burner. It became the number one political issue. All along last year said, look, they didn't inflate enough of the debt away. They didn't inflate debt to GDP down low enough. This tightening is going to be a disaster, and it's not going to be a glide path. It's going to be, I'm sure I probably said it to you before, they're not operating a dial, they're operating a switch. And we just saw it's a switch. So, and this isn't the first symptom of it, right? By August, September, we saw the Fed go into an operating loss position, which was just foreshadowing of what we just saw this weekend. We saw stocks and bonds combined last year have the worst combined year in the United States since 1871. We saw the Treasury market underperform U.S. equities in a top 20 drawdown for stocks for the first time on record, going back to at least 1966. That's a statistic from Michael Gayed. So there were all these symptoms that were telling you you didn't inflate the debt away enough on a debt to GDP basis. And so now here we are, it's gotten acute in the banking system. And so I think what we are going to see is a basically sort of game back on, reacceleration of the Argentina with U.S. characteristics, or U.S. with Argentine characteristics, however you want to phrase it, where you're going to get sustained high inflation. It's going to accelerate back up. It probably will be an increasing political issue, but cynically, it's not an election year, so they've got a little bit of time not to care. And in the meantime, keep in mind that the U.S. Just announced they were going to change the way inflation was calculated beginning January this year. So last month was the first, the February numbers were the first time they were reported. I had thought that they would start underreporting inflation right away. I was wrong. The numbers came in hotter. I will note that as you lay it out, based on the people that really dig into those numbers, what they have done means that the year ago comparisons get tougher as we move into the back half of this year. So in theory, if you're going to restart to rerun the U.S. with Argentine characteristics playbook, where you're going to have a reacceleration in inflation, all else equal, those comparisons get tougher. And so that will keep it less egregious in terms of the increase in inflation than it might have otherwise been without those changes. But if we didn't want high inflation, then there's a whole laundry list of things we shouldn't have done that we've already done. So in my view, it's baked in the cake at this point.
Now, crude oil rallied quite a bit in that 2021 period that you're talking about. We've seen quite the roller coaster in the wake of the Silicon Valley Bank news, with WTI crude down more than $5 in the overnight session through the European session before U.S. even opened on Monday morning. Then back up $4 in the U.S. session to retest its five-day moving average, then back down $2 before the session ended. So, wow, we're really looking at a market that's confused, I would say, about what, you know, whipsaws up and down. It doesn't know what's going to come next. Luke, what's going to come next?
I saw that today. I was watching oil with great interest. I came in when I turned on my screens this morning. I saw two prices. Not that often do I turn on a screen and say that's the wrong price. And I turned on my screen this morning, knowing what we knew coming into the session, and there were two numbers on my screen that were the wrong price. The first price that was the wrong price was oil, in my view. As I saw it down like that, I said, that's the wrong price. And then the second price that was the wrong price was TLT, long-dated treasuries, which was up 3.5% this morning in early trading. By the end of today, TLT was down. I think it finished up marginally, but it was red at like 345. So that has started, I think to maybe move toward being the right price. Because with these day after situations, I think it's important that there had to have been a lot of margin calls this morning, right? So whatever positions people had on, they had to degross, et cetera, until they figure out what's happening. And so it's a little bit of a, it's a little bit of a fog of war type of situation. But as I take a step back based on, okay, here's my understanding of events. Oil was trading at the right price or wrong price this morning, and TLT was trading at the wrong price this morning. And so let's see how that plays out by the time this recording hits Thursday. Let's see how it plays out in coming weeks and months. But I think it's really good for oil. I think it's not good for treasuries, for long dated bonds. You know, if the Fed's done, if the Fed's going to backstop this kind of stuff, what's the bull case on duration? That the next step will be yield curve control. Like, sure, I guess that's a bull case if they set the cap lower than this, but in terms of yield, but there's obviously a lot better ways to play that on a relative basis. So to me, oil and TLT were not trading at the right price this morning. TLT started, made 3.5 percentage points of progress in the correct direction, or what I think is a correct direction, through the course of today on Monday. Oil kind of bounced around, like you said. So let's watch and see what happens.
Now, this is going to sound crazy because it is crazy, Luke, but let's talk about what this means for equities, because before we had the biggest bank run in U.S. history, equities were rolling over well below the 200-day moving average. Seemed like perhaps the end of the bear market bounce was in and we were headed lower. But as crazy as it seems, if what we're going to see is an end to the hiking cycle, and it seems like investors are just paying attention to the Fed policy more than the real economy these days, does that mean that it's time to buy the stock market hand over fist because the end of the hiking cycle is going to take it higher as everyone celebrates the biggest bank run in U.S. history, reinvigorating the stock market, as crazy as that sounds?
Very Argentine indeed, isn't it? Something that, you know, our emerging market listeners will know, be intimately familiar with, but the Westerners, maybe not so much, at least not yet. But I think we're about to get up close and personal view of it. I think it probably will be good for stocks, paradoxically. I think it will probably be better for industrial and commodity related equities. It'll probably be better for emerging markets. It'll probably be better for, you know, for foreign equities, whether it's Japanese or Europeans or all sorts of different equities. Because remember, everybody going into this, when we talk about the trade that either everybody has on or doesn't have on, right? Nobody had that inflation was coming back on to kind of kick this off. And the other trade that really nobody has on, or that everybody has on, I should say, is everybody's max long the dollar in terms of dollar short squeeze, in terms of U.S. equity market cap as a percent of total global market cap, equity market cap. It's either at or near all-time highs. So if this is it, I think equities will do well. You probably see actually emerging market, European, Japanese equities probably do better than U.S. equities. I think you'll see commodities and industrials do better than big tech. And I think it's going to be really good for, like I said, for gold, for Bitcoin. Well, Bitcoin's up 15% today. I suspect we'll see more of that, but we'll see. So I do think it'll be good for equities. And I think you'll probably see some capital move away from the dollar, if for no other reason than just positioning.
Luke, let's talk about the Russia and China situation. Something I just heard for the first time this weekend is someone in China apparently made the statement, look, as much as the U.S. doesn't want China to provide weapons to Russia, is for every weapon that the U.S. provides to Taiwan, we're going to provide one to Russia. So there, tit for tat. How is that and everything else going on between China-Russia escalation of the war situation, how is all this going to translate to market?
Other than one factor, I don't know. It's not good for geopolitics. It's not good for peace. It's hopefully not going to escalate. For markets, I don't have a strong feeling about it other than one factor, which is my sense, as best I can tell, is that consensus is that rising tensions and war would be good for U.S. Treasury bonds as a flight to safety. And I think that is incorrect. I think if you take a look really just at any war, you're hard-pressed to find a war where bonds buy you more real goods at the end of the war than they did at the beginning of the war. But we're talking about two great powers between the U.S. and China. We're talking about Russia, who is the world's biggest energy and commodity exporter and a nuclear power. And these tensions, I think you have to go back to the analog to World War II. And if you go back to World War II, what you find, we published this chart a couple different times in the last 3 or 4 weeks to our clients, you can look at long-term government bond yields. And in late 1941, you were basically, U.S. economy was re-slowing. You were at generational lows in terms of yields on long-term U.S. government bond yields. And they were 2% yield. And then the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And almost instantly, 10-year or long-term government bond yields went from 2% to 2.5%. So the bond market crashed. And then the Fed came in and capped bonds, capped bond yields, 10-year at 2.5, 3-month, I believe it, I think it was 0.375%, maybe it was 0.875%. But the point is that, as Zoltan Pozsar wrote in August, war is inflationary. There is nothing more inflationary than war. Another way to look at it is during World War II, U.S. deficit as a percent of GDP rose by 25 percentage points. We're already at, call it 8, right? So you'd be talking about a major war adding, you know, 1,000 basis points to as a percent of GDP to deficits. Say it's just 500 basis points. And that, when I look at this into this situation we described already, where there's has been and continues to be a worsening fundamental mismatch between Treasury supply and demand, I don't know how any of this stuff is going to work out, China, Russia, U.S., other than to say that if it does for any reason, there's a geopolitical accident somewhere, if it actually goes hot somewhere, if it keeps up, this is not good for bonds. The last place you want to have your money in a war is bonds. And so let's hope it doesn't continue to escalate. But then you say, okay, is it, what is that? That's an inflationary impulse. You should have money flowing out of bonds broadly, sovereign debt in particular, of all stripes, into things like gold, Bitcoin, commodities, real estate, hard assets. Those, if there's really a war, those are the kinds of things you want to own. Equities can serve as that as well. So let's hope that cooler heads prevail. But I've been really, really surprised how a laundry list of U.S. senior policymakers have been paraded up on the weekend news shows over the last 2-3 weeks and talked about how they're going to get tougher with China and how this is a red line and that's a red line, with seemingly no understanding how they are kicking out the legs underneath their own treasury market. Because you look, if there's going to be a war with China, if there's tensions with China, if there's a new Cold War with China, the last thing you want to own are bonds, because inflation is whatever you think inflation is going to be, you take the over. You almost couldn't, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, inflation's going way higher. So that's why I say I don't know, other than to say they need to be very careful, because if and both sides, look, you know, China will have to fund internally too. So bonds are not priced in, but China runs a surplus, right? They've got a current account surplus. So they're not as dependent on foreign financing as the US, but they would have issues obviously as well. But the point is bonds are not priced in the right zip code if you actually have some sort of war. That's my only takeaway as it relates to markets.
Let's talk about how this plays into a longer-term situation or series of events that you've written and talked quite a bit about, which is looking at everything from U.S. tax receipts to the overall indebtedness of the country. You've basically made a prediction that the U.S. dollar, which has been the world's global reserve currency ever since the end of World War II, would eventually lose that status. And you made crazy bold predictions years ago that some countries would stop settling oil transactions in U.S. dollars. People called you a nutcase for even predicting such a crazy thing. Well, that's now happened. You predicted that foreign central banks would divest some of their U.S. dollar holdings. People really called you a crazy lunatic over that one. Well, that's now happened. But what's kind of interesting to me is despite that a lot of these predictions that were associated with your view that the dollar would eventually decline substantially, they all came true. But the dollar, as they were coming true, was actually making kind of a generational high just a few months ago at 116. Was that the final peak? Are we coming off of that? Or are we potentially going to retest that again? How does this play into the longer term story of the dollar's role in the global financial system?
Yeah, I mean, to clarify, we've always said that the dollar's reserve status, the post-71 reserve status, would eventually be restructured, needs to be restructured, and would eventually be restructured because it is no longer in the United States' interest to maintain that system. Now, within the U.S. right now, you've got sort of the two crowds. You've got the defense establishment who understands how the post-71 dollar has hurt its ability. It has forced the hollowing out of the U.S. defense industrial base. And you're hearing and seeing this all over. If you read a number of different things, there have been some very good articles talking about how hard it has been for the U.S. to replenish certain industrial ammunition type stuff in Ukraine. And that's just sort of a proxy war. We're not throwing our full weight behind and we're chewing through supplies, again, because we have underinvested in our defense industrial base, our manufacturing base, because that is the cost of the post-1971 dollar, as people like Michael Pettis and others have noted for a long time. You have to offshore your industrial base. That's fine if you're fighting people in Iraq that are, holding AK-47s and driving Toyota trucks. But if you're going to fight industrial powers, if you're going to have great power competitions with other great powers, you better have an industrial base. And you can't do that with the post-71 dollar, because by definition, you have to offshore your manufacturing. By definition, your biggest export has to be treasury bonds. And it has been up until recently. And so I continue to think the U.S. dollar reserve status not only will be, but is in process of being restructured in terms of the implication of what it has done. I can go back to actually September 2014. And in the earlier days of FFTT, we wrote a report highlighting that, the dollar is rallying. This is could be in part because foreigners are beginning to move away from the dollar for energy pricing on the margin. You had begun seeing Russia, China, Venezuela, Ecuador, a few others running into dollar shortages. In particular, the energy exporters who were still running current account surpluses with oil at that point still in the mid-90s, that should have never happened unless one of two things happened. Either they had become much more corrupt in like the last 2 to 3 months, where they were pulling those dollars and sticking them off in, the Caymans or Switzerland or something, or they had begun on the margin selling more oil to the Chinese outside the dollar system. And paradoxically, the initial impact of moving away from the dollar in energy markets, of de-dollarizing commodity markets, is to squeeze the dollar higher. And we've said this over and over and over and over, and it's something I still get a lot of questions about, but we've said it over and over and over, and that is because if you think about it, there's a huge installed base of dollar demand from all the dollar-denominated debt outstanding, and there is not a huge installed base of yuan-denominated debt offshore because A, no one denominates debt in yuan, and B, the Chinese run surpluses, so they're not going to end up with a lot of offshore yuan anyway. So if you start shifting just small amounts of the global energy market, which current prices, $2.5 trillion a year. I mean, it's real money. If you start shifting just small percentages away from the dollar to the yuan, you're going to take just a little bit of dollar liquidity away from that huge bid for dollars from all that dollar debt. That's good for the dollar. And you're going to shift just a little bit of yuan into a market where there's really not a lot of bid for yuan. That's not good for yuan. So paradoxically, as China shifts from one to the other, just on the margin, it's good for dollars. So when you say, where could the dollar go? It's a function of how fast. So China's got to be careful. They do this too fast and they kill their own currency. So they can't go it too fast. And that's, you have to also offer something in return in terms of settlement of goods, in terms of recycling, in terms of gold, all of which they've sort of done. But it's all else equal in the short run, really, really positive for the dollar, paradoxically. The other factor in terms of trying to decide, is this the dollar peak or was this the dollar peak or was it not, is, look, it depends on how much pain the U.S. government, the Fed, is willing to endure. And as long as that pain is private sector, I think the Fed's willing to endure it. I think the U.S. government's willing to endure it. Once that dollar strength impacts the Treasury market, Powell doesn't want to be the first Fed chair to oversee a failed Treasury auction. And every time the dollar gets too strong, as we saw, these auctions start getting really sloppy. And that, to me, is really the governor on the upside in terms of the dollar, is once these auctions get too sloppy, you know, he doesn't want to be Arthur Burns, but he doesn't want to be the first guy to oversee a failed Treasury auction either. So when you boil all that down, there's multiple factors that are interplaying with each other and reflexively sort of bouncing back into each other. When I look at those factors, you're starting to get more critical mass in yuan energy. You are starting to get the Treasury market to where it is borderline the Fed losing control of it in terms of dysfunction versus levels we've seen before. And when I look at that on the DXY, yeah, I would say, is it the ultimate peak? You know, if we have an absolute death spiral, you know, there's sort of no limit it could go to Brent's point. But if we don't have sort of this death spiral, which, oh, by the way, is completely uninvestable. If people think they're going to be like, oh, I'm going to wait till the dollar goes to 200 or 160, and then I'm going to, you know, move, like, good luck. But I think we probably have seen, and grain of salt, I thought we probably saw it before. So, you know, full disclosure, I was wrong before that. Hey, I thought 103, 104 was a peak before. I was wrong. So was 115 the peak? You know, I'm going to step back in the box, take another swing. Yeah, it probably was, given what we're seeing in the Treasury market. But, you know, let's see.
Okay, so in terms of how all of this translates to portfolio positioning, it sounds like the strongest conviction is long your choice of gold or Bitcoin or a combination of gold and Bitcoin, whatever your favorite anti-dollar trade is, and maybe also a long on oil. Have I got those two right? I'm guessing that the oil is a lower conviction than the gold or Bitcoin. And what other trades should we be thinking about here?
Yeah, we came into this year, we said to our clients that we were sitting at 20 to 25% cash and short-term treasuries, and we were 20 to 25% gold miners and Bitcoin when we came into this year. Maybe it was 25, 30% on the last one, but the point is, and then we also owned energy-related commodities and some industrial equities. We've been referring to this as our barbell approach. And the reason we've been highlighting this barbell approach is that there are a number of factors that nobody alive in trading has ever seen and lived for through before. First bursting global sovereign debt bubble in 100 years. First peak cheap energy cycle in a long, long time. This rise of another great power competition. All of these, you know, the derivative side. So the barbell to us is an acknowledgement of, and it's how we're investing our own money. It's an acknowledgement to really, I have high conviction in how this game is going to end, which is with inflation. Because once sovereign debt bubbles, sovereign debt crises rarely end in deflation. However, the cash and the short-term treasuries are really a nod to, I have no conviction in the path. So, you know, as I look at events like this week, I'm inclined to probably take a little bit out of the cash and short-term treasury bucket, and press the bet a little bit on some of these inflation sides, inflation reads. But again, I think it's really important to be humble about how this could go in terms of the path. There's just so many risks that are unknowable, unhedgeable in the short run that, you know, to me, I don't mind owning short-term debt. I don't want to own duration. To me, you know, as you look out for portfolios, I think more people need to start thinking about, you know, instead of the 60-40 portfolio that has sort of worked for my entire career, certainly, and probably closer to 40 years, you know, where it's 60% equities, 40% bonds, and you toggle the 60% equities around amongst growth and value, depending on where you are in the cycle. I think it might be 60, you know, it's probably 60-30-10 or something, where it's you toggle 60-30 back and forth between growth or value equities or domestic international equities. And then the other 10, you sort of have some bonds and you have some gold and, you know, just based on where we are in a variety of different cycles. So that's what we've told clients. That's how I'm thinking about it. You know, the volatility we've seen, I think is going to continue. And I think it's going to continue in things people have never seen volatility like this in. People have seen crazy volatility in equities. We've seen crazy volatility in commodities. I think we've started to see, and I think we're going to continue to see equity and commodity like volatility levels in G7 rates, in G7 FX, in G7 sovereign debt. And we started to see a bit of that last year. And I think people thought that was an anomaly. I don't think that was an anomaly.
Doesn't that imply some really big systemic risk? Because there's a lot of things in the financial system that are really designed around the concept that bonds are inherently low volatility instruments. If bonds become high volatility instruments, doesn't that break a whole lot of stuff?
It's a great point. And yeah, probably.
Well, Luke, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Before I let you go, please tell us what you do at Forest for the Trees and how our listeners can find out more about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, we aggregate a large amount of different publicly available data points in a unique manner, trying to identify developing economic bottlenecks. It's been my experience over almost 30 years in investment research that excess returns accrue to those sectors that stand to either benefit from or are in the wrong, you know, not in the right position relative to developing economic bottlenecks. So if you're interested in more, to learn more about it, check us out at fftt-llc.com. Or you check us out on Twitter at Luke Groman, LukeGromen.
Again, that's FFTT-LLC for Forest for the Trees, LLC.com. Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at MacroVoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Luke back on the show. Now, before we bring Nick Galarnik in to take a dive into that post-game chart deck, let's discuss what happened at Silicon Valley Bank, what it means, and how it affects the outlook on Fed policy and markets moving forward. Now, before, let's start with a background story. What happened last week that caused the sudden collapse of what used to be one of the strongest regional banks in the country?
In my opinion, this is all about interest rates and the Fed's very aggressive hiking cycle. As I've said several times here on Macro Voices, the Fed was sure to continue hiking interest rates to fight inflation until they broke something. Well, now it's official. They broke something. And frankly, I think they got lucky that so far there hasn't been too much contagion to the rest of the regional banking system. A few other regionals showed signs of stress, and then on Wednesday, Credit Suisse started to blow up, but it looks like the Swiss National Bank has already stepped in to shore up their liquidity. But it's still early in this story, so we need to stay alert for more signs of stress and contagion in the banking system. Now, going back to Silicon Valley Bank, they specialized in offering banking services to Silicon Valley startups. When these companies raise tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars in a venture capital round, that money is usually intended to support the company's payroll and other expenses until they develop enough revenue to have a positive cash flow. But when that lump sum of money from a funding round is received, it won't be spent right away. The company that receives it has to do something with all that cash until until it's time to spend it. Now, almost anyone who graduated high school knows that bank deposits are only insured up to $250,000 per account, and the depositor risks losing any larger deposits if the bank fails. So pretty much all grown-up adults, and especially grown-up adults that have jobs like being the treasurer of a new startup company, know better than to leave millions of dollars in cash in an uninsured bank account. Depositors are expected to be smart enough to move anything over the $250,000 insurance limit into T-bills or some other secure instrument. But Silicon Valley didn't want you to do that. They wanted those deposits in cash, because they wanted to be able to make money investing them. So they offered various incentives to encourage their customers to abandon grown-up sound risk management and carry very large cash balances which were uninsured in their accounts, allowing the bank to make a tidy profit by investing those deposits in longer-dated treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. Then the Fed's hiking campaign began, and long-dated fixed-income securities started to lose value rapidly. From what I've read, there's an accounting rule that allowed Silicon Valley Bank to designate those long-dated bonds as hold-to-maturity assets. And apparently, under this rule, that means they didn't have to mark them to market, which would have devastated their balance sheet. But eventually, Silicon Valley Bank reached the point where the losses necessitated raising more capital to keep the bank solvent. It wasn't a 2008 kind of situation where nobody even knew what the bonds were worth. It wasn't nearly that bad. The losses are easy to understand. They resulted simply from the aggressive pace of the Fed's hiking campaign to fight inflation. And that means other banks are facing the same issues. The Silicon Valley venture capital community are no slouches when it comes to understanding solvency risk. So when they got word that Silicon Valley Bank was in trouble, they protected their own investments in their own portfolio companies by calling those startups who had big cash deposits with Silicon Valley Bank and telling them, hey, get your money out of Silicon Valley while you still can. The resulting bank run is one to go down in the history books. It was more than twice the dollar size of any prior U.S. bank run. But more importantly, it happened almost entirely in just one day, last Thursday. Prior bank runs have taken weeks to play out. Then all eyes turned to whether this event would spark a broader panic across all U.S. regional banks. And that started to happen. Regulators responded very quickly by pulling out all the stops and promising a full bailout for Silicon Valley Bank over the weekend, including all those uninsured deposits that represented something like 97% of all Silicon Valley Bank deposits. So the federal government just up and volunteered to insure something that was not technically insured and was supposedly at risk if the bank failed. So your tax dollars just got put to work bailing out a bunch of very, very irresponsible people. Now, Janet Yellen and Jay Powell seem to be taking a victory lap for saving the day. They think they've done something spectacularly wonderful here. In my opinion, they just created a massive moral hazard risk, sending the message to other bankers that they can get away with almost anything. And the Fed will always be there to bail them out, no matter how stupid they are or what goes wrong. We don't know how many other banks are in trouble, and they're not telling because they don't want to panic their customers into another bank run like the one that took out Silicon Valley Bank.
Okay, got it. Now, what does that mean for Fed policy moving forward?
A week ago, almost everyone felt sure that the Fed was going to continue its rate hiking campaign, with some people expecting a 25 basis point hike next Wednesday, and even a few suggesting 50 basis points might be in the cards. Now it seems like just about everyone in markets is unequivocally convinced that this event marks the de facto end of quantitative tightening. Almost nobody thinks that a hike is even possible next Wednesday, and quite a few pundits are calling for an easing campaign to begin next week. I'm going to go way out on a limb here, Patrick, and say that I'm not convinced that the Fed is done hiking. Now, to be sure, I agree that the Silicon Valley Bank failure occurred as a direct result of the financial system not being prepared to weather the pace of rate hikes that the Fed has been making. And I also agree that it would be horrifically reckless and irresponsible for the Fed to continue hiking without first at least pausing to assess the banking system's ability to absorb mark-to-market losses that those hikes are causing to the bank's fixed income holdings. But just because something is reckless and irresponsible doesn't mean the Fed won't do it. And let's not forget that inflation is very real and very much does need to be dealt with. So it's not nearly as simple as many market observers suggest when they say that the Fed should immediately ease rates to lift the mark-to-market burden off the shoulders of the banking system. The inflation that the Fed is fighting is very real. There's a very good case to be made that they should continue to aggressively hike rates in order to combat that inflation if you actually believed what they're saying, which is their job is not to bail out the financial system, but just to take care of the broader economy and Main Street Americans who are very much coping with inflation. But as has now become very clear, if they don't do that, there's a good chance that they'll blow up more regional banks, forcing more bailouts. And every bailout is a message to bankers that the Fed has their back no matter what, and that only exacerbates moral hazard risk across the entire banking system. For well over a decade now, I've been saying that the end game for the easy money policies that followed the great financial crisis wouldn't come until inflation started to run away. I predicted that would be the moment when the Fed would suddenly have their hands tied. They'd be unable to paper over all of our problems with easy money, and that's when I predicted that the rubber would meet the road. The events of the last week are exactly what I've been predicting for all those years. We've finally reached the point where the Fed is damned if they do and damned if they don't. If they start to cut rates here, inflation will get worse and become anchored in the economy. The coming recession will take the edge off, but as soon as the recession is over, inflation will be back with a vengeance, and the Fed will be right back in the same spot. On the other hand, if the Fed hikes rates next week, markets will throw a conniption fit. And if they don't hike, and especially if they cut, they'll be giving in to inflation. My best guess is that they'll pause and do nothing next week and wait for the market to stabilize. But I don't think that hikes are off the table for the next meeting on May 2nd, especially if next month's CPI comes in hot again. It sounds crazy to say this, but the recession that we've all been waiting for hitting the stage hard would be about the best thing we could wish for at this point. That would take the pressure off inflation and give the Fed a better excuse to eventually start cutting rates. But I think the real lesson here is the Fed is running out of options and losing control over the markets. Inflation is not under control, but the Fed's ability to fight inflation appears to have reached the point where they'll break something even bigger if they keep trying to fight inflation with more rate hikes. It's a bad situation with no good alternatives. And of course, it's happening during a presidential election cycle, so it's certain to become politicized as well. There will probably be threats of firing Jay Powell. You know, who knows where this is headed next?
Okay, how does that translate into the markets?
That's not clear yet. There are two big unanswered questions which will determine everything. The first is whether the formative regional banking crisis has really been contained or not. The Fed would like us to believe that, hey, this is just a one-off freak event with Silicon Valley Bank, and hey, don't worry about it. The contagion that started to occur, First Republic, a couple of other banks, causing people to pull their money out of other regional banks. Hey, look, that was just a flash in the pan, emotional knee-jerk reaction that's completely behind us now. Nothing to see here. Everybody relax. The Fed has made it clear that they're going to keep depositors whole no matter what happens. So everybody relax. Don't panic. The competing viewpoint is that all these regional banks were long-duration risk, just like Silicon Valley Bank, and they're probably sitting on big mark-to-market losses on those positions, which, just like Silicon Valley Bank, are being concealed from the public view by accounting rules that allow hold-to-maturity assets to be exempt from mark-to-market accounting rules. Why? That implies that this could be the beginning of a landslide that's too late to stop from blowing up a bunch more regional banks before this is over. At first, all we saw is just a little contagion to other regionals.
But then it looked like it was safely contained. Everything's under control. It all blew over. Oop, wait. Then Credit Suisse blew up on Wednesday. Now it looks like that's contained too, thanks to the Swiss National Bank stepping in. But the question to ask is, where's the next shoe going to drop? We don't know yet whether this contagion is already ending or if it's just getting started. Simply put, this is a confidence game, and the Fed is trying to be proactive by making it clear that they have depositors' backs in order to squash any further panic. That either stops the bank runs or it doesn't, and we just don't know yet which it's going to be. And the Fed has a strong incentive to lie about what's really going on in order to shore up confidence. So we won't know what's really going to happen until it either happens or doesn't happen. The second question is Fed policy. The Fed has no good options at this point, so they have to choose between bad ones. Right now, most market participants are assuming that this marks the end of quantitative tightening and that it won't be long before the rate cuts begin. I think that's very dangerous and complacent thinking. If inflation continues to run hot, the Fed just might continue hiking rates despite all of this. And if they do, it will invite an outright panic in the markets. So the first big tell is next Wednesday's FOMC statement. And the next tell after that will be whether or not any more regional banks are forced into receivership. Expect the government and the media that generally caters to government's desires to be presenting a story that all is well, it's all blown over, there's nothing to worry about. That's the perception that they need to foment in order to avert more bank runs. Don't believe it at face value. We won't know whether this is over until shit stops blowing up for a few weeks straight, and it takes a few weeks to wait for that to play out.
Yeah, Eric, I agree. It's really now more about whether or not the Fed has to pivot from the policy. I mean, we just last week or the week before, we were having Fed testimonies and such a huge hawkishness to the Fed. Looked like rate hikes were going to go out throughout the remainder of the year. And so if there is a Fed policy shift, it's really about how the market prices it in. So I completely agree. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on that red button over Luke's picture that says looking for the downloads. Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with those EIA inventory numbers.
On a national level, crude oil built 1.6 million barrels, but Cushing, Oklahoma drew down 1.9 million barrels, and the big drawdowns were on finished products, with gasoline drawing down 2.1 million barrels and distillates drawing down 2.5 million barrels. U.S. production holding unchanged at 12.2 million barrels. Tape action, brace for impact. It's straight down. And even before inventory, the market was in free fall. This really, I think, is a reaction to the SVB news. And as I said in last week's podcast, I thought a test of $66 was possible on WTI. Well, that's exactly what we got on Wednesday. We got a bounce off of that level. Does that mean that it's the bottom and the bottom is in, or is it just a dead cat bounce and we're still headed lower? I'm not sure, but the market is clearly pricing in the coming recession, and I don't know whether the selling is over. It really is going to depend on whether or not this banking crisis is ending or just starting. I remain very strongly committed to my long-term view that because of lack of investment, there will eventually be a global energy crisis because the global economy cannot return to pre-pandemic growth trajectory due to insufficient supply of oil and gas. The thing is, the global economy is nowhere close to returning to its pre-pandemic growth trajectory because it looks like we're already headed into recession and maybe we're about to have a banking crisis. Maybe it's already blown over. We'll see what happens. So bottom line for crude oil, It's going to really depend on what happens with the broader economy and broader markets. Obviously, if the stock market crashes and we have a banking crisis and it's 2008 all over again, then we're headed much lower on crude oil. There's a possibility that the $66 number that we saw on Wednesday was the final low, but it would take the banking crisis blowing over in a decisive way and seeing some action from the Fed confirming that, or some news that really reassures everyone that there's no more systemic risk in the banking system. In that case, I think it probably is the low. So we'll see what happens, but I don't think it's possible to make a high conviction directional call here just because there's too many uncertainties as to what's going to happen next.
Eric, you know, for me, crude oil, you're bang on that that drop to $66 was a possibility. We were looking for that as well as a risk that if the support lines gave out. The big question for me is in the coming trading sessions will be, will the bulls react on this with a buy on dip and get it back up into the trade range? For there to be a further weakness like you suggested could possibly occur, it would, to me, be failed price action to get above 70. And just day after day consolidating at these new lower levels, that could open the window for a short-term decline to 60 on the downside. But overall, my first approach to this is that this was just a washout. There was a lot of stop losses, a lot of psychology along all those major support lines. And when they given out, it forced a wave of selling as the support lines all broke. Will be very interesting to see whether or not the buy on dip traders can create a quick recovery in this in the coming days. Now, let's talk the markets, though, guys. Nick, I wanted to ask you here, like, obviously, this was an incredibly volatile week. What was your take on the S&P and what levels are you watching?
Yeah, so last week I mentioned that I thought we might rally up before we came back down. But obviously, the failure of Silicon Valley Bank came into play and we had that nice move to the downside prior to that. Right now, the expected move for this Friday's OPEX, which is a very important monthly OPEX, March 17th, that's tomorrow. We have an expected move right now of about 70 points from the current spot. So upside would be 39.60 or so, downside 38.20. And we have heavy support at 3,800 and heavy resistance at 4,000. Keep in mind right now, the largest open interest area is at 4,000 on SPX. So that's a large gamma flip area. If we get above 4,000, we could run pretty fast. And to the downside, the large gamma area is around 38.50 or so. So if we get below that and close below that, then that could push us further lows in the next couple of weeks or so. Now, obviously, the volatility has picked up a lot, and we expect a lot of whipsaw action. But it's important to remember to manage your risk in these times, and you know, think about your risk reward in each trade individually. So again, downside 3,800, upside 4,000 or so. Those are the key areas to watch. Now, Eric, based on this, what are your thoughts here?
Well, it all depends on the Fed's next move. If they hike, the market will tank. If they cut, what does that really mean? Well, if they cut, it means that the Fed is losing control of markets. And that should be bearish. And I say they're losing control of markets because they're no longer able to fight inflation as they need to do, because if they did that, it would crash the market. They don't have the control. If they're losing control, that should mean the Fed put has expired forever. It should be very bearish. But crazy as it sounds, I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised if they began cutting, if that caused a melt-up in stocks to 4,300 on the S&P. Why? Because as Louis Gav explained perfectly last week, we have an entire generation of professional investors that have grown up believing that the only thing that matters is Fed policy, and when the Fed cuts, stocks go up. As long as people believe that, they're going to buy stocks if the Fed cuts, and stocks are going to go up, even though I don't think it makes any sense. If the Fed is forced to cut here, it means they are scared shitless of what could happen in terms of contagion risk in the banking system. That's a very, very bearish message, but I don't think it will necessarily be interpreted that way, at least not initially. Eventually, reality will sink in, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's up before down on equities in the event of a rate cut.
So my take on the equities is a little bit interesting because I kind of look at the fact that we had obviously these bank failures. We had the bond markets make extraordinary moves, repricing what will be inevitably some sort of a Fed pivot. And you would think that this would have resulted in substantial broad market volatility. But we have a scenario where the S&P 500 basically dropped 200 points, just over 200 points in this past week. And we have a scenario where many of the past market drops were actually far more violent than this. We're holding above that support zone, Nick, that you were talking about around that 3,800. I mean, this is a market that basically up till now has completely brushed off the fear associated with these bank failures. We'll talk about the NASDAQ chart here in just a moment. But to me, this is a scenario where, well, if the market isn't going to crash on this kind of news, then from just a reflexive perspective, that would imply that once everything settles down, there's definitely room for an upside breakout. Obviously, like you're suggesting, it's going to a lot of it's going to hinge on the FOMC and whether Powell does in fact accommodate in the market's reactions will be important to that. But every day that this market doesn't break below 3,800 increases the likelihood that the next impulse might actually be bullish. Nonetheless, Nick, let's move on because I wanted to talk about this NASDAQ a little bit. What levels are you watching on the queues?
Yeah, so looking at the NASDAQ right now, again, very similar to the S&P, we have an expected move of about 7 points by tomorrow's OPEX, March 17th. So upside would be around 307, downside around 292 or so. Key resistance area right now is at 300, which is right where we are right now. Support area, key support area rather, is at 290. And in terms of the gamma areas, the key gamma areas right now with option positioning, there's a large call wall right now at 310 or so, which is also the next area of resistance on the upside. And the large gamma flip area is at 305. So if we get above 305, chances are we push to 310 pretty quickly as well.
You know, it's interesting about your comment there, Nick. You know, also, obviously, we have a big OPEX coming up here. And as all of these things roll off into next week and throw some, you know, central bank stuff into the mix, it's going to potentially open up the volatility. But what's interesting to me about the NASDAQ, even more so than the S&P, is that when you look at a two-week range, the NASDAQ is trading at a two-week high or close to its two-week highs. It's basically brushed off this entire banking crisis, and individual names like Microsoft and other things are doing very well. Things are turning up. The NASDAQ is holding solidly above its 200-day moving average. It's again, just back to that point I made on the S&P 500, the market doesn't seem to be so worried about this regional bank crisis and is actually almost setting up now for a potential bull breakout. This is so weird because obviously intuitively, one would think that this would create panic, and certainly that was something what we'll talk about here on the VIX chart on the next page. You would think that there would be some sort of panic and market selling, and it's just not manifesting that way. And so to me, I always like to look at the markets in a way that, well, if the one reaction isn't gotten, then the opposite is likely to play out. And so in this scenario, if the market isn't going to sell off on this news, well, once everything settles, I'll be watching to see whether actually the next response is actually for bullish breakouts. What I want to move on, though, on page 7, we have that VIX, the volatility index, and we had that spike in volatility finally. Obviously, everyone's grabbing at protection here in this kind of circumstance. But Nick, what I found really interesting is that we're not even near levels where we were back in October when the last major market sell-off was. So while volatility did spike, it really does seem to just be almost a very benign jump in volatility respective of the situation. What's your take on it all?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I've said for the past few months or so that the support area is around 18 on VIX, and you know, the 25 area is a very key area. If we break above it, we can usually push like 35, and you know, we spiked to 31 this week, came back down again. But I think this might be a delayed reaction more so. Like looking today, for example, the regional banks even though they recovered a couple of days ago, they're back down again today. So, you know, we're seeing names like FRC is down like 30% as I speak, 35% as I speak. You have Western Alliance Bank Corp down 12%, and PacW right now is down 18% or so. So it's possible we see more fallout in the coming weeks from this crisis overall. And that could be the catalyst, the next leg up in the VIX, right? I am surprised we haven't seen, you know, further downside movement overall in broad markets and correlating spike in the VIX to, you know, 35 or so. Because when you talk about, you know, bank failures, that's a pretty big issue that reminds us a lot of 2008, 2009, right? But again, here right now, we're expecting, based on the VIX levels, about, you know, 1.7% moves per day in the broad markets. So, and we're getting that roughly each day. So it's important to understand the, like, the expected moves each day based on the VIX alone in broad markets and plan accordingly. And as I said before, the zero DTE SPX options are acting as hedges in the shorter term than the 30 DTE. So that's kind of suppressing the VIX because the demand for the 30 days till expiration contracts is not as high as the zero DTE, right? So that could be a reason why we're not seeing this huge spike in the VIX as we've seen in the past, perhaps. Now, on page 8 here, we have the U.S. dollar index, which has been on a bit of a run the past few weeks or so. And we have FOMC next week. You know, we just had CPI and PPI, so it'd be interesting to see what Powell says next week, which will affect the dollar greatly. But what are your thoughts here?
Well, the rally we've been watching in the dollar was halted by expectations of either a pause or a pivot from the Fed in reaction to the Silicon Valley Bank events. But I don't think it's that simple. The market is waiting, I think, for the Fed's next move. So we'll see what next week brings. But I don't think it's as simple as assuming that the Fed is absolutely done hiking here. I think it might be just a pause with a possibility of a hike on May 2nd.
Well, Eric, we're recording this here before we know what has come from the ECB. And one of the interesting things will be obviously what reactions will come on the euro that could certainly influence the first impulse to finish the week on the dollar index. But obviously, all eyes will be on that FOMC meeting and whether or not there is some degree of a pivot or at least a stall in the rates. Overall, the dollar was incredibly oversold and it's been mean reverting. And the way I kind of look at this is that if the reversal we had yesterday sticks in any way in the post-ECB period, then we could still have a move up to 107, 108 on the upside. We'll certainly have to see how this plays out.
Now, on page 9 here, we have the chart of gold futures, which have been in a nice bull run the last week or so. And looking at this chart here, it looks to me that we're going to possibly break to new all-time highs, again, as investors flock to this safe haven commodity. What are your thoughts here, guys?
Prior to Silicon Valley Bank, I thought the correction wasn't over yet and we still had lower to go. Now it's much more complicated. If the Fed pivots, like many people expect, and starts cutting rates, gold should go to the moon. I mean, it's already up more than $100 since Silicon Valley Bank. It'll go up another $100 if the Fed cuts here. And that's what will happen eventually. So I think that the longer term outlook is definitely very bullish for gold. But I'm not convinced that the Fed is done hiking, and most people seem to be, but I'm not. I think they're most likely to pause this month, let the dust settle, watch the data, and maybe hike again on the May 3rd meeting. If that were to happen, that would mean that gold maybe still does have lower to go, and we'll see what happens. Maybe we will get down to the 1780 level that I was hoping to buy on the dip. Ultimately, though, what the Fed does next is going to determine what happens for gold. It will go down so long as the Fed continues to hike, and when it's eventually clear that the Fed will give up on fighting inflation, and I know that's coming at some point, I'm just not as persuaded as a lot of other people are that we're already at that point. When we get to that point and they start to cut to rescue the economy from the recession, that's when gold is going to move sharply higher. So long term, the bullish view is very clear. Short term depends on the Fed.
Yeah, Eric, yeah, you're bang on there. Like, ultimately, gold could have been in the gutter for even 6 months or more, waiting for inevitably when some sort of a pivot and easing cycle could potentially begin. The fact that this regional bank crisis has kicked in and bond markets continue to increasingly price in, the fact that the Fed is likely to stall, that certainly has moved up the timetable for that this potential gold rally. The big question, will it happen? To me, the first reaction is always positive. Clearly, gold is advertising that it started some sort of bull run. The big question is, can they hold on to the gains? To me, long as dips are being bought, even if there's a temporary break below 1900, I'd love to see buy on dip traders immediately get it back above 1900. Just I want to see the general pattern of accumulation really continue to confirm itself here. Obviously, with the ECB later today and then subsequently the FOMC next week, there's lots of news that is going to be the catalyst for the next gold move, but certainly initially looking pretty bullish. All right, guys, I wanted to wrap up here with just looking at bond yields. On page 10, I have the 2-year yield, and on page 11, I have the 2-10 spread. And the 2-10 spread went from minus 110 basis points to at one point trading at minus 40 basis points, just an extraordinary steepener kicking in. And it really was driven by an outright collapse in yields at the 2-year level. And that really came, obviously, as the bond market suddenly, in a shocking way, had to start pricing in this Fed pivot. This is a pretty serious and meaningful turn in bond markets. And what'll be really interesting to see is if this steepening trend is actually the new norm. Are we going to see a scenario where we're going to start suddenly see the yield curves get positive again in the coming weeks? It's certainly the thing to watch as we move forward from here.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @macrovoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening, and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.